I'm Joe Wood, and I believe.
Livingston, West Lothian, Scotland, November 1979. Forestry worker Robert Taylor is walking his dog along a forest path near the M8 motorway. As he strolls along the path, he sees what he later describes as a flying dome, 6 meters in diameter, hovering above a clearing. Taylor smells a foul odor, then sees a number of smaller spheres descend and seize him. He loses consciousness. When he wakes, the objects are gone, but his truck no longer starts. He walks home looking disheveled with torn clothes. Police find ladder-shaped markings in the ground where the incident occurred and conclude Taylor was a victim of assault. Many ufologists, however, believe Taylor's sighting is the only human encounter with extraterrestrial beings to be subject to criminal investigation.
Welcome to Alien Nation, the show about extraterrestrials and UFOs, asking the question, are we alone? In Alien Nation, I talk to other Earthlings about their otherworldly encounters, and we love hearing your stories, so please get in touch. I'll tell you how to do that at the end of the show. Joining me today is the Executive Director of the Mutual UFO Network, or MUFON. Welcome to Alien Nation, Jan Harzan. Is the weather nice there in California?
It's beautiful. I'm looking at a gorgeous view of the San Ynez Mountains here in Palm Desert, California. It's gorgeous.
Oh, you would not want to see what it's like here. Anyway, let me ask you, Jan, I'd like to know really about your experience of seeing a UFO.
Sure. Well, this is what actually inspired me to get involved with an organization like MUFON.
Yeah.
When I was 10 years old, my brother and I were very much interested in the subject of UFOs because back in the 1950s and 60s, when we grew up, this was front page news on almost every newspaper in the world. Of course, at the time, they were called flying saucers.
Yeah.
And we decided that these things must have some kind of electromagnetic engines in them. We decided we'd build one. So we designed a 30-foot craft with 3 pulsed electromagnetic engines, and we were going to build this thing.
Oh, how
we were just we were just little kids at the time, so it was kind of, you know, fancy. But we did draft it up, and I remember drawing up a diagram of it, and we were talking about it. Then one day, my mother invited us to go with her to the store, and as she was shopping, we stopped by the magazine rack, and we found a little half-sized magazine called Flying Saucer Review, which in fact was printed out of the UK. We bought a copy of it, took it home, and we were reading it on his bed. I remember in his bedroom. And in that magazine, it said that flying saucers are seen around military installations, nuclear power plants, and places where anti-gravity research is being done. So we looked at each other and we said, well, we're doing anti-gravity research. Maybe one will come here. And literally within 30 days, I'm asleep in my bedroom at 6:30 in the morning on a Saturday. And my brother walks into my room and wakes me up. And he says, there's somebody outside and they're trying to break into to my bedroom. And I said, what do you mean they're trying to break in? He says, well, they're playing with the screen. I said, well, did you look out the window to see who it was? He said, no, I didn't look out the window. I said, well, then let's go take a look. Now, this was approximately 6:25 probably, because we actually went out the door at 6:30 to go check out things in the backyard. But we went back to his bedroom, and it was 6:30 in the morning on a late April day, right before the time change. And the sun was already up above the horizon, so it was bright outside. We went down the hallway. I went to his bedroom. I was at one end of the house. He was the other end of the house. And so I went down to where his bedroom was with him. And we stood at his door and we looked at this window and there was nothing going on. So I said to him, let's go out in the backyard and check it out. So we walked back down the hallway. As we got halfway down the hallway, I'm looking back at him talking. And, or actually he's doing the talking. I'm looking back at him listening. And all of a sudden he says, look. And I spun around to look in the direction he was looking, which was a wall of windows we had in our living room with white drapes on them, and the sun was coming in from behind, so it was backlighting the drapes, or actually shining in through the drapes, and I didn't see anything. So I said, well, what'd you see, Jeff? So, well, there was a shadows somebody standing against the window.
Oh, really? And
when I told you to look, it floated backwards. And I thought that was a very interesting comment, because I'm thinking, was it floated? What do you mean floated backwards? You know, floated backwards. Now, he was just seeing a shadow. But when I looked, I didn't see anything. So at this point, I'm thinking, okay, you know, you got me up at 6:30 on a Saturday morning. You're just trying to pull one over on me. You know, you're trying to get me to go out the backyard and middle of the morning here and look at something. So we went into the family room, past the kitchen, and on the kitchen wall was a clock. And I remember distinctly the hands both being pointed down, which means it would be 6:30 in the morning. Most people don't know what an analog clock is anymore, but it was an analog clock. So we went out into the garage and then into the backyard to the end of the house, and we looked back towards his window, and again, there's nothing there. So I'm thinking, okay, you've got me, buddy. You know, you got me out here at 6:30 in the morning. You pulled one over on me. Good for you, you know. We turned to go back into the house, and there, 30 feet from us, hovering 10 feet off the ground, is a landing craft with four landing gear on it,
no,
making a humming noise like a transformer on a telephone pole. I don't know if we have them in the U.S., transformers that cause power, and they have this hum to them, this little hum. Yeah. So we're staring at this craft, and we're going, oh, my gosh.
How big was it?
It was approximately 8 to 10 feet long, by four feet wide, by 3 feet tall. I guess, put it in meters here, it was about 3.5 meters long by meter and a half wide by a meter tall.
Yeah.
And it was shaped like a brick. If you took
a brick
and you blew it up to those proportions, and then completely smoothed the surfaces, and it was bright orange. It had blue corrugated landing gear on it, four of them. They came out like dryer hose down. They just hung out and down. Black suction cups on the bottom, and then brown crossbars. Between the landing gear on each side, like there's like a scissoring function. So if the landing gear scrunched up, these scissors would cushion the stuff movement. So I'm looking at this thing, and this is what went through my mind. The first thought I had was, oh my gosh, these things are real. I'm sitting here staring at this thing.
Yeah.
As a mechanical device of some kind. The second thought that went through my mind was, this thing looks like it's man-made. And why did I think that thought? Because in the scissoring function, right where the scissors come together, there was a bolt in the center of it. And that bolt looked, you know, like something we would have on a device, a bolt.
Yeah.
But as I continued to stare at the craft, I noticed that it was completely seamless. There was not a rivet or a bolt in it. And this was April 1965, and I don't think we had the ability to bend metal like that without rivets and without, you know, seeing a seam somewhere. I mean, it was almost like blown glass, but it was a metallic material. And then I thought to myself, boy, these guys must be awfully short because it was only 3 feet tall. But then I thought, well, wait a minute. There's no doors or windows on this thing. How the heck do they get in and out of it? So with those thoughts going through my mind, I said to my brother, I'm going to go in the house and get a camera. So I ran to the garage, went into the garage, and went to go into the house, and we locked ourselves out. Now, I don't even know if that's possible, but we had. So I am pounding on the door as hard as I can. And there's a little discontinuity in my knock, I noticed, which is kind of weird. And then all of a sudden, the door opens up, and my older brother says, what's going on? And I said, nothing, because I didn't want to stop and explain anything. I ran into the house and got the camera, ran back out into the backyard, and my brother, Jeff, is standing on our swing set, staring out to the west. And the craft is gone. So he's climbed up the ladder of the swings for the slide, and he's standing at the top of this thing as far as he can get up, and he's staring off into the west. And I said, well, what happened? He said, well, the craft just hovered. It was like frozen in the sky. It was the weirdest thing, just frozen. It's like taking a car and levitating it 10 feet off the ground and just having it hang there in the sky. It'd be the weirdest thing you'd ever see. And he said, it slowly started to drift to the west, and then all of a sudden it shot off over the horizon, like just poof, like a bullet, just gone.
Oh my God.
So we're just looking at each other, you know, he's 9, I'm 10. We're saying like, who's going to believe us if we tell him this thing? You know, so we really didn't really say anything to our parents or our brother. We just kind of went back about our thing. And the funny thing about it was we completely lost interest in building this craft that we had designed. It was almost like it was never even another thought in our mind.
Isn't that weird? Like that whole experience took that away.
Well, we find this a lot in cases where people can have a completely different demeanor after the sighting as they do before. It's almost like they might be talking about flying saucers and they have a close encounter. And then after that, they don't even talk about it anymore. It's very strange.
Yeah, I interviewed somebody who had been abducted, and he said it took him ages to talk about it.
Oh, yeah. It's not something you can talk to people about, particularly in those days.
Yeah.
Because on Monday morning, I went to school, and I remember vividly being standing on the playground. I was in fifth grade at the time, talking to my best friend, Tom, and I'm telling him, hey, Tom, this really weird thing happened this weekend. And I explained this whole story to him, probably in a lot more detail than I just went through now. And he's staring at me. So I paused to let him talk. And do you know what he said?
I can't imagine.
He looked me in the eye and he said, do you want to go play baseball?
Like,
and I'm thinking to myself, did you just hear what I've been thinking to myself? Like, did you just hear what I told you? This incredible story, what this happened. And he didn't even register with him. It just went right over his head and he couldn't deal with it. It was like, hey, you want to go play baseball? Which is generally what we did on our recesses. We went out and played games and stuff. But anyway, that was my first experience with it. And from that, I learned you just don't talk about this to a lot of people. So for many years, I didn't really say anything about it. I just kept it to myself.
And how does your brother feel about that story, you know, all that experience?
Well, see, for me, it had an inspiring thing. It got me interested in how these craft, it inspired me to go get an engineering degree, go to work for one of the world's largest corporations, and try to figure out how this thing works. For my brother, it was a very debilitating experience. For him, he got into drugs and alcohol, spiraled down. Fortunately, he's back. He's gone through rehab and I've helped him through some things and he's doing much, much better today. But for him, it was a very negative experience.
Yeah. Oh, isn't that mad how it's so different for the pair of you? Yeah.
Yeah. I personally, we don't have any facts to back it up, but believe he was actually taken aboard the craft. I was not. I was, for some reason, I was separated. I think it was, I was purposefully sent in to go get a camera so I would separate from him. So they could take him. So whatever they did to him, it didn't have a positive effect on him.
Well, I mean, you said it was only 3 foot high.
Yes, yes. But we have cases where people have actually looked into a craft and reality is actually transformed. Where, I mean, they look into a 6 foot craft and all of a sudden it's the size of a football field inside. So.
Oh, really? How interesting.
Yeah, if you have the ability to manipulate space-time, which is how we believe these craft are getting here,
yeah,
you can really do some weird things that just are unimaginable to us.
Yeah. So then when did you join MUFON?
It was many, many years later, actually. I was a branch manager for IBM in Orange County, California, and I was working with a business coach, and he asked me one day, if you had all the money in the world, Jan, what would you do? And I said, well, I'd probably be doing UFO research. He said, really? He says, why is that? And I told him the story, which I told you guys here a few minutes ago. And the next time I came back for a coaching session with him, at the end of the session, he handed me a piece of paper, which was a flyer for the UFO Expo West at the LAX Hilton. Might have been the Hyatt, but it was at the LAX airport. And so I went to this conference. I didn't even know there were UFO conferences. I never heard of such a thing. This was in the late 80s, early 90s.
Gosh.
And there were 1,000 people at this. I was blown away. I mean, 1,000 people at this conference. And so one of the vendors tables at the conference was a MUFON Los Angeles vendor table. So I stopped by and I chatted with them, found out what they were about. And I started attending their meetings at the Pickwick Center in Burbank, California, and was fascinated by the fact that there were actually hundreds, if not thousands of people like me who had an interest in the subject. I never knew anyone even cared about UFOs, honestly.
Yeah, I went to my first UFO conference in Manchester, actually, this year, and I was really surprised how many people were there. And, you know, it's a thriving thing, isn't it? It's
Well, you know, you think about, they estimate about 10% of the population has had some kind of a close encounter or some kind of a sighting where they want to know. I mean, once you've had one of these sightings, like, you want to know, like, what is this thing? Why is it here? Who are these people? What are they doing here?
Yeah.
It's It's a really a mind changer, honestly.
Yeah, I had a great sighting in Brazil, and it changed me forever. And I thought, my God, I need to know everything I can possibly know. So I think that's basically why I speak to lots of people.
Yeah, and you have to believe that within Parliament and within the U.S. Congress and other governments of the world, that we have leaders in there who've had these experiences.
Yeah.
And the question is, why aren't they speaking out? Why don't we know more about what our governments know? Because I can just tell you, there is tons of and I think it's because of national security. I think that is the answer to the question. But it's just,
I think too many people would be too afraid. I think the world would be in panic right now. We're all safe, and religion and all that sort of, it's a form of control. So if you didn't, so they don't want to tell us.
But yeah, well, I think it's that. And I think it's also because, I mean, once you break the news that we're not alone, then you get 1,001 questions by the press and by the people that you can't answer. Like, who are they?
Yeah.
Where are they from? What do they want? Can you protect us? You know, it becomes a there's really nothing in it for them to tell us. I guess that's the bottom line.
Yeah.
And well, most politicians work under the premise that there's got to be something in it for them. So, yeah.
So what is your role? What do you do within MUFON then?
Well, so I started out as a member, because we're a membership organization, although we provide information to the public for free on our website, MUFON.com. And I became a MUFON field investigator, and I investigated cases for a number of years. And then I became a state section director for Orange County, California. And eventually we ended up running the national conference here in 2001 in Irvine, California. And it was so successful that the executive director, who had just taken over from Walt Andrus, John Schuessler, asked if I would join the business board and help him run MUFON. So I got on the MUFON business board. And from that, helped develop the CMS case management system, which is what we use to collect reports from the public today and then do investigations and follow up. And eventually, when John stepped down, he asked if I could take over the organization. Well, at the time, I couldn't. I had young kids, and I was working full-time for IBM. But eventually, a few years later, when I retired, the board asked me again if I would take over MUFON. And so I was blessed with being able to do that. So it's just a wonderful organization with a lot of wonderful people, all of them volunteers. And we just we're all rabid and avid UFO seekers trying to get to the truth of what's going on with this whole phenomenon.
And when did MUFON start?
It was, we're actually celebrating our 50th year this year.
Gosh, that long?
Yeah, 1969. It was founded by seven gentlemen in the Midwest. They actually called it the Midwest UFO Network at the time. But quickly, other states joined in, and then other countries wanted to become part of the organization and join what they had created. So they had to change the name. So they kept MUFON, but they changed the Midwest to Mutual. So it's the Mutual UFO Network.
Oh, I see. And how is it funded then? If everybody is a volunteer, how is it funded?
Well, we're 100% funded by the public. So we have memberships, which you can go online and get, which gives you access to our monthly journal and other information. I think it's, I can't convert between euros and dollars, but it's like $5.98 a month. So it's less than two cups of Starbucks coffee. Yeah. And then we have people who donate. We have an annual symposium we run, which with speakers, where we make a little bit of money on. And then we have a store. So on the website, you can click on store and you can buy shirts, caps. So those are the four sources of funding. It's the memberships by the public, some donations by the public, our symposium, and finally our store sales. So that there encompasses pretty much 99% of the funds that keep MUFON running.
Oh, I see. Okay, that's good. So let me ask you then, what is the most interesting case that you've had?
Well, there have been so many. Gosh, let me give you two. We had a case that came to us back in 2015, which was actually seen in 2013. It was called Case 74282 of a barbell-shaped craft. A gentleman and two of his buddies were bear hunting in northern Canada. They're actually from the U.S. And he, in fact, ran a Defense Department contracting firm and was CEO for it. So they were up in these trees, you know, hunting bear and a lookout. And they came down at the end of the day to go home. And as they were driving home, all of a sudden, a large barbell-shaped craft, 170 feet long by 40 feet wide by 30 feet tall, came cruising over the top of their car, and they were just dumbfounded. So he went to grab his camera, and his camera had wouldn't turn on. And then he went to grab his cell phone, and his cell phone had shut off. And this is typical in many cases because these things throw off such a high electromagnetic pulse that it shuts off electronic equipment most of the time. So it was within 400 feet when they first observed it. By the time it got about a quarter of a mile away, the camera equipment turned back on. So he was able to film this on his video camera. And when they got back to where they were going, he played back the video, and the image was completely wiped from it, except there was this pulsing going on. And if you remember my sighting where I was talking about building a electromagnetic engine with pulsed electromagnetic engines, this thing had a certain pulse to it, 123 hertz. So he kind of back engineered it because he was an engineering type guy. And he said, I think this was superconducting electromagnets being spun and pulsed at each end of this thing, because it was a barbell shaped thing, at being pulsed at 123 hertz. So I don't know what that means. Are there any engineers out there or people trying to build a craft? Maybe try doing that. But that was just fascinating because he got this on videotape and then he did the analysis of it. And that's on our website, case 74282. And then the other one was more recent. I think 2017, could have the date wrong, but it was a young boy, 17 years old. He was on the back porch of his stepmother's home in upstate New York during an electrical storm. And he was watching the heat lightning out in the distance, and all of a sudden a craft came over the top of the house, over his head, and down and landed in a field just beyond the house. And he ran down to look at this thing, and it had landed in the dirt. And as he approached it, of course, it took off and shot off like most of these things do. They just shoot off into space or wherever they go. And our investigator was able to stake out the site and do radiation readings, and within the diameter of the space where the craft had landed, background radiation, it was six times background radiation. If you stepped like a foot outside of that, the radiation levels went right back to normal background radiation. So definitely there was something.
It's confined and it doesn't leak over at all. It's confined to that space.
Well, it's fascinating that you can get that kind of evidence, physical evidence that says something was there. You know, it wasn't like this guy made up the story. I mean, it actually happened. You know, so and there was an imprints in the ground as well. So where the landing gear were. So, who's doing all this? Is it a secret government program? I don't think so. Is it someone from another planet? Possibly.
Yeah.
Is it someone from another place in space and time? Maybe. I mean, it's like all that just gets your mind just racing, trying to say, what is this? And why is it here? And what is it doing? And
was that a saucer-shaped craft, or was it square?
It was circular, kind of like a, let's see, how would I describe it? It was kind of like a circular, but it had some depth to it. So I don't know the exact dimensions, but let's say it was like 4 feet tall. It was like a big circle, about 4 feet tall, and then it had a little dome on top of it, and it had lights around the outside of it. Many of these things have lights on them. I don't know what that does, but and the lights will blink, you know, in some kind of a fashion as they go around the craft. So, it was. He drew a picture for us. That's on our website as well. So, these things happen. They're very rare events. We get between 500 to 1,000 reports a month from around the world of craft reported to us, or lights in the sky and different things. About 70% of the time we can identify it, or it's information only, or there's not enough data there to make a determination. But clearly about 30% of those become unknown, what we call unknowns. And that's kind of our research database, if you will, for craft. We talk about the five observables, which means that, which tells us that it's probably not terrestrial in origin. And those five observables, if I can remember them all here off the top of my head, the first one is instantaneous acceleration. If you remember my sighting when my brother said it shot off over the horizon. So from a standing start, these things will shoot off over out of sight.
Yeah, mine almost, did. Mine did.
Yeah, it's like a bullet, you know?
Yeah.
So that's the first observable. The second is hypersonic velocities. In other words, velocities above 3,700 miles per hour, because currently we have no known aircraft that can go faster than that. But these things can been clocked at, you know, tens of thousands of miles per hour, which is just incredible.
Yeah.
Cloaking, they cloak themselves. In other words, they can become invisible and visible. And you think about my sighting, when we went out to the edge of the house, I should have been able to see the craft because it would have been right on my right. But there was nothing there. And as we got to the end of the house and saw that there was nothing down by the window and turned around, all of a sudden it was like snap of a fingers.
It was there.
Yeah. So this kind of cloaking, if you will.
Yeah.
And then transmedium travel. These craft are seen moving between space, air, and water as if none of it's there. We've even seen them fly into mountains, and there's no crash. There's no big explosion. They just, like, go right through the mountain. So for some reason, they can manipulate matter, time, space, and matter, where it's almost like it's not there. You know, they're transiting this medium, these mediums with ease, with nothing. And we can't do that today. And of course, the last one is anti-gravity. Yeah. I mean, these large craft, we have craft 1,000 feet long that have been reported, hovering in the sky, and they just sit there. And they don't fall out of the sky. There's no motors, there's no rotors, there's no engines, there's no nothing. They're just hanging there, like my sighting, where the craft was just hanging 10 feet off the ground, like it was just frozen in the sky.
Yeah.
And most of the time, they're silent. 90% of the time, these craft are reported as being completely silent. But the next sound that's heard is usually a hum. And, of course, mine was a humming noise. It was humming like it was a resonant frequency of some sort.
Yeah.
So those five observables are what tell us within our database what most likely is not of terrestrial origin. It's something else from someplace else in space and time.
Isn't that amazing? Gosh, I want to know what it is, how they can do it, and how can they go through mountains and I mean, I can understand them making themselves disappear, because I've seen pictures of ones that go behind clouds or cloaked in a cloud. I can understand all that, but oh my gosh, my mind boggles. My mind goes crazy.
Well, it just tells you that our understanding of physics and the construction of our universe is very, we're very much novices or neophytes. I mean, you know, these people, whoever they are, whoever this intelligence is, I mean, they understand our universe much better than we do.
Yeah, they certainly do. Now, I've heard that you had a really interesting conversation with Ben Rich, the former CEO of Lockheed Skunk Works. He was the one that did the was the father of the stealth, wasn't he?
Yeah, well, Donald, he was the engineer, head engineer on the SR-71, which was the Blackbird spy plane.
Yeah.
Back in the 60s, and that's what propelled him to take over from Kelly Johnson, who was then the CEO of Lockheed Skunk Works, and become the second chairman of CEO of Lockheed Skunk Works. So, yeah, he was quite an engineer type guy, and he also happened to be a graduate of the UCLA School of Engineering. Mm. So one day I received a notice from the school saying, "Hey, for certain alumni, we have this special event where Ben Rich will be speaking." And so with my interest in UFOs and knowing that they built all the top secret spy planes, I thought it'd be fun to go. So I invited my friend Tom Keller to go with me. Interestingly enough, I'd met Tom at that UFO conference I went to, the very first one. He was standing there with his jaw wide open, looking around like I was. And we ran into each other, started talking, and realized that he was an engineer like I was. He worked in aerospace. I worked in computers. He went with me, and we were sitting there, and Ben was regaling the crowd, about 200 engineers, with his 40 years at Lockheed Skunk Works. It was a slideshow. This is 1993. And his last slide was a black disc zipping off into outer space. And he ended his talk by saying, "We now have the technology to take E.T. home."
Oh, really?
And the entire room broke up laughing. They thought he was joking. And Tom and I just looked at each other and we said, "Did he really just say that?" And so afterwards, we stuck around, and about 20 of us, 15 to 20 of us, gathered around Ben and just started asking questions. And he shared some very, very interesting things with us. One of the things he shared was that, think about stealth. The way stealth was developed was a Russian mathematician had written out the equations for stealth. Yeah. It was the Lockheed engineers who took those equations and used it to design a craft which would be invisible to radar. And that's why the F-117, the stealth fighter craft, it looks so weird. It's so angular. It's because those angles are not by mistake. They're very purposeful based on the equations that these engineers worked out to figure out how to build this thing. Similarly, for faster than light travel, there's a set of equations. It's called Einstein's general theory of relativity. And with this, you can figure out how to travel faster than the speed of light. So he did say, we found, we're talking about Lockheed Skunk Works, we found the error in the equations, and we now know how to travel to the stars, and it won't take us our lifetime to do it. Those were exact words. So I chased him out as he was leaving. I chased him out the door because I really wanted to know. I mean, I asked him, I said, Ben, what equations? And he just looked at me like, yeah, right, I'm gonna tell you the equations. Yeah. So, but when he finished up his discussion, he said, I gotta go now. And he turned around to walk out to the parking garage. So I kind of chased him to the end of the room. And as he's walking, I said, Ben, I said, hi, I'm Jan Harzan. I said, I have a real fascination for what you were talking about and the kind of propulsion things you're speaking of. I said, can you tell me how it works? And he looks at me like, who are you? You know, like, who are you? And he says, well, let me ask you a question. How does ESP work? And I thought, oh my God, I wasn't expecting a question. So, I mean, the first thing that went through my mind is that, I don't know, all points in space and time are connected. He said, that's how it works. And he left. So I don't know if he was answering my question, you know, that my answer was right, or he was just saying ESP is how it works. But I do think his, point being that all points in space and time are connected, and perhaps the equations show how that works. I'm not a physicist, and you know, my mathematics are from 40 years ago when I went to college, so I can't fathom it. But I do speak with a number of scientists currently working on faster than light travel, and they're all telling me that sometime in the next, you know, 50 to 100 years, we'll have this capability ourselves. So in the white world,
that soon.
Yes. Oh, yeah. Very much so.
Oh, my God.
It's not so much a mathematical issue anymore because we now understand the equations. It's more of a engineering issue.
Yeah. Space-time engineering.
Exactly. Exactly. You've got it. You're well on your way to being faster than light.
Oh, God. That's so interesting. My God.
I don't think people understand that the advances we've made in the last 50 to 100 years are going to pale in comparison to the advancements we as a civilization are going to make in the next 50 to 100 years. I mean, you won't even recognize this planet when we're done with it. I mean, in fact, most of us might not even be here. We might be out on some other planet, some other galaxy, some other solar system.
I expect I'll be on some other planet in 100 years' time. And when's the next convention?
It's in July. We usually do our conventions in July. It'll be in Las Vegas, Nevada. You can go on our website and check it out. You can already make reservations for the hotel. We're still lining up the speakers for it, but we're going to make it around military witnesses speak out, UAPs, military witnesses speak out. There's been a huge outpouring of military and Navy and Army and other people talking about this now on national television here in the U.S. And I think there's still a large part of our population that thinks this thing is a bunch of nonsense. And, you know, if they're willing to look at the data and they're willing to listen, I mean, in my opinion, disclosure happened on December 16th, 2017, when the New York Times published a front page article talking about the Pentagon's secret UFO program. And the individual who was running that program, Lou Elizondo, stepped out of government and he became a private citizen. And he has dedicated his life to trying to get this information out to the world. I know Lou personally. He's a hero, a great guy, and he's doing it for the right reasons. So this has been a big, big help and push for us. But even despite all that and all the press coverage that got, I still run into people who like just cannot wrap their brain around the fact that we're not alone. It's just mind-boggling to me that you would have such a small myopic view of the world. The one thing I would leave with your listeners is that the other thing MUFON does, which is probably our best kept secret, is we have an experiencer research team. We call it the ERT. It's headed up by Kathleen Marden, who is the niece of...
I've spoken to Kathleen, yeah.
Yeah, and she's the niece of Betty from Betty and Barney Hill back in 1961, the first reported abduction case in the United States. And she and George Medich, who's a medical doctor and former pitcher for the New York Yankees, and their team of 25 people, basically we take reports from the public just like we do UFO reports on their abductions or their experiences or their meeting with different entities. And they provide a service where basically they talk to these people and get them whatever help they need, whether it's some of them are suffering from post-traumatic stress, to help put them in touch with doctors who can deal with that. Some just want to join a group, small group to talk amongst other like-minded experiencers.
Yeah.
Some of them just want to report their case. Some of them just want to talk, someone to talk to, because there's nobody in their family or their work or their home life that they can really share their experience with without people looking at them kind of askew, like, you're crazy, man.
Yeah. So. Yeah, that's true. Well, that's really great to know for people out there who've seen something and don't know where to turn. MUFON's right there for them.
Go to our website, and if you click on Report a UFO, actually, we actually ask you, the very first question we ask you is, are you reporting a UFO sighting, an abduction experience, or an entity sighting? And so you can check whatever box is appropriate, or all three boxes if you saw a UFO and you were taken aboard and, you know, you saw entities. I mean, click all three boxes. Yeah. And then that information goes to our teams, and they can help you there. We also have an experiencer questionnaire. If you fill out the sighting report, the last question we'll ask you is, would you like to fill out an experiencer questionnaire? Those questionnaires are what go to our experiencer research team, and then they contact the witness if you give us permission to contact you, and we'll actually work with you and work through your story and help, as I said, connect you with whatever resources you feel you need to help you. Yeah.
Well, that's fantastic, Jan. That's really interesting.
Thank you.
Thank you so much for talking to me today.
Thank you, Joe. Really appreciate the opportunity.
That's our show for today. I really hope you enjoyed it. If you did, please rate us on whatever platform you get your podcast from. It helps people like you find us. Today's show was produced by Mike Hansen for Pod People Productions. Associate producer Colette Cooper, and recorded at Hackenbacker Studios by Jamie Allen. Theme music by Mike Hansen and Jamie Allen. Special thanks to Nigel Heath and our narrator, Mike Hansen Sr. If you want to share your stories, we'd love to hear from you. Just email info@podpeopleproductions.co.uk, subject matter Alien Nation. Beam me up next time. I'm Joe Wood, and I believe.